He's going to be talking on causal loops in local retrocausal models of quantum mechanics. Yossi, welcome.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Hugh, and thanks, Guido and Jenan, for organizing the conference. What I'm going to talk about today is about theories that try to be more classical. So we'll mention quantum states, but you'll never see them. It's like the Holy Spirit, I mean, around. But I will talk about theories that try to be local and to explain, I mean, quantum phenomena is an emergent phenomena in a local, so without action at a distance, or influences that are faster than light. And then to talk about the challenges that are related. So in the talk, I will talk about the EPR experiment. I will explain, I mean, intuitively what's going on. Then I talk about the relationship between correlation and probabilities and causation. I mean, very briefly, what I need for the talk. Then I'll talk about a very famous and ingenious theorem. Again, I mean, just talking about probabilities, you won't see quantum states. Why local models of seemingly non-local phenomena is difficult to get, at least given certain assumption, it's impossible. And then I'll talk about the local retrocausal models in which all the influences are local, but there is both forward and backward causation, and explain briefly how they get around, I mean, this problem or this theorem, and then the complication that arise. I mean, and the main complication is that there will be causal loops in which effect cause their causes, and that create a problem with respect to predictions. So, I mean, so the main thing would be at the end, I mean, to talk about these causal loops, I mean, in that would be predicted by these theories in some experiments, and to see what happens to prediction, to frequency of events. And my main argument would be that if these models are not careful enough, then they would lose, I mean, their predictive power, and all would be empirically adequate. So let's start with the EPR experiment. You have a source that emits pairs of particles in opposite directions, and then you can make different measurements. I mean, the L and L star and the R and R star are two different kinds of measurement that you can choose the last moment to make, I mean, one of them. And they usually, I mean, in these experiments, I mean, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen Bohm version of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, the quantities that we measure are spins. You can think about it as an internal angular momentum that particles have, but really doesn't matter. I mean, the only thing that matters is that you can measure along different directions. And the other thing that is important about this experiments that you get curious correlation between the outcome that you make on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And this correlation can survive, in theory, any distance. They don't decay with distance. So you can make this measurement so far away that no slower than light signal could go from one measurement to another, which means that intuitively, I mean, you can, the only way to influence each other would be by some action at a distance that is faster than light, which would get us into trouble with relativity theory. And the other thing that is important to know, that if you measure spins in this, if you measure spins in the states of these experiments along the same direction on both ends, you get always the opposite results. So if spins are like one and zero, or up and down, I mean, so if, or if you want to think about it, spinning left or right, I mean, if one spin left, the other one will spin right. And that's a law in quantum mechanics. Now, some notation, the sigma, well, before I talk about the notation, one thing that is important is that according as Guido explained, and I mean the quantum in quantum mechanics, the particles, I mean in these experiments, are in entangled states. They don't have a separable states. They're in a sense like one entity, and that's one of the explanation. I mean, why when you measure one particle, you influence immediately, I mean the other particle and the outcome on the other particle. According to the model that I'm going to talk about, this is only the surface phenomena. This looks like they are entangled, but in these models, I mean, direct causal models try to explain it as this is just as the statistics. I mean, if you take the quantum probabilities, I mean, they just show certain correlation, but really fundamentally, these outcomes are not correlated at all. Okay, so in space-time, I mean, if you think about time along this direction in space, one-dimensional space, the emission event is there, and then the particle are emitted in both directions. So that's space going to the left and going to the right, and that time's going from zero to some time. And the measurements, this measurement is the outcome, and the measurement itself is outside the light cone of this measurement. So influence between them would be faster than light, or between events that, I mean, need the faster than light signal to be connected with each other. Now the idea, I mean, of the model that I'm going to talk about is now the correlation. There are correlation between these events, and they suggest, I mean, that there is a non-local influence between the events. But I mean, one way to try to explain it is to explain the correlation as a result of some common cause that is in the past light cone of both outcome, which means that the influence, I mean, of this emission state on the outcome would be slower than light, or at most the speed of light. Okay, so correlation causation. The quantum. Whenever I use the psi, it means a quantum state, which in our, I mean, world or our interpretation of retrocausal local models is just a state that gives you statistical correlations or statistical probabilities, averages over ensembles of particles, and running many times the EPR experiment. Now these are correlated, since these are according to these probabilities, the outcome are correlated, and there is a suggestion that there is a non-local influence, and indeed, I mean, most of the interpretation of quantum mechanics predicate non-local causation, and therefore they are very difficult, I mean, to reconcile with special relativity. But you have to remember, I mean, two important principles that are used in this literature and were used, I mean, implicitly at least by Bell and many others, is two principles that relate, I mean, probabilities or correlation with causation. One of them is that correlation have always a causal explanation. So correlation between distant event are either due to some direct causal connection between them. Direct are using, we have to be careful because the idea of direct, I mean, here is more intuitive, and it's very difficult to make it precise, but I mean, it's good enough for us. Or the correlation between these two event might be due to some common cause that cause of, each of them in a correlated way. So the common cause, I mean, operate to produce one event in tandem with operating the other. I mean, and basically, it has. I mean, you can think about it as the common cause. I mean, creating this correlation. Now, the other principle that is used, I mean, in causal inference, I mean, in the causal literature, and also used, I mean, at least intuitively by John Bell. In his theorem, is the Reichenbach principle of the common cause that says that if the correlation are due to a common cause, then there is some such the common cause, or there is some common cause that would screen off the correlation. So it will make the probability, the joint probability. I mean, correlation is just a case in which the probability of joint event do not factorize, they're not equal to the product of each of them. So if the probability of the event A is half and the probability of the event B is half, then let's say the probability of AB would be 1/8 instead of 1/4. So that's a case of correlation. And according to Reichenbach principle, there is always a cause of both A and B, that would, once you take it into account in your probability, so the probability would be determined by this common cause and maybe some other things, then actually you will see that the probability of A and B is a product. And the idea is that the common cause somehow explains the correlation, and the idea beyond that is also that the common cause, in a sense, operate to produce A and B independently of each other. And therefore, the probability of each of them is actually independent. I mean, the probability of the joint is just a product of one probability and the other probability. If you have any question about these things, I mean, clarification, I'd be happy to answer. Now, so it will be, if the correlation in the EPR experiment could be produced by a common cause, and the common cause would be the state of the particle in the source, it won't be the quantum state, because the quantum state, according to this view, is just a statistical, a probability. It's an average over different experiments and different states that the particle can have at the emission time. But if there was such a common cause, if there was some states that the particle which is more fundamental in a sense than the quantum state. Quantum state is just list of statistics. Then this correlation, we would be able to explain them by perfectly local mechanism, and it would be much more classical in a sense. So that's the idea. I mean, the problem is that John Bell showed that, given plausible, very plausible assumption, such an explanation of the quantum correlation is impossible. And that was actually in reference, it seems that Einstein and Podolsky and Rosen may have had an idea of explaining the correlation by such a common cause, but what Bell shows that if you really consider different experiments and take them into account, you get a certain probabilistic condition that are called the Bell inequalities that violate the statistics of quantum mechanics, the prediction of quantum mechanics that are considered empirically adequate. Okay, so now I need to explain, the Bell theorem and what is the nature of this local model in order to be able to explain the retrocausal local models. So the first thing that is assumed in this model, and they are completely general, they can be applied to different theories, and they don't talk about the particular way, in which things happened. They don't talk about the details of the physics. They talk more about the state. They assume that there is a state and the probability that these states give rise to. So one thing is that is assumed that there is some fundamental states that is more complete in a sense and more fundamental. I mean, that's the intuition than the quantum states. The states of the particle pair, that together with the setting of the measurement apparatus, so the properties that you're going to measure, the state of the measurement apparatuses, together determine the probability of each of the outcome and also the joint outcome. So the assumption is that there might be different states like that whenever you prepare the experiment. They might vary from one experiment to another, but that each of these states that you might not know, they are called hidden variable because, we don't have even to commit ourselves to their exact nature, and that these states would, together with the state of the measurement apparatuses, the relevant states of the measurement apparatuses, the type of measurement that we make, together we determine the probabilities of outcomes, single and joint outcome. Okay. Now, what I explained, I mean, the quantum state is just a statistical state, and in the same quantum state, each run of the EPR experiment, there is the same quantum states. I mean, there is, I mean, for instance, there is the singlet states that Guido talked about, in which the particle are entangled and give rise to a correlation. But in each run of the experiment, there might be different fundamental, the lambda state, the hidden variable, or the hidden states that we are after, that would make everything local and nice. There might be different states like that. And the assumption is that the quantum states reflect the some surface statistical phenomena, while the lambda, these lambda states, I use Bell's, I mean, notation, reflect the more fundamental nature of the world, the quantum world. So the next assumption is that in these states, if you really knew these states and you shape your probabilities according to these states, I mean what these states imply, then the probability of outcome in each run of the experiment would be uncorrelated. So there will be like normal classical situation in which you have two particles that that are emitted from the source, and each of them has already the information of what to do. I mean, whether in terms of determining the outcome or determining probability of outcome, they are really unconnected to each other. So that's the factorizability, and it can be derived from some principle that is similar to the common cause. I won't talk about it. Okay, the next assumption is, since there could be different states, more complete lambda states, hidden variable, and these states and all of them are compatible with the same quantum state, they have to have certain distribution or probability. Whenever you prepare the EPR experiment, the EPR bomb experiment, there is the same singlet state. But in each run of the experiment, there might be different fundamental states. And the question is, what is the probability of these states? So there might be a distribution. I mean, the distribution of these states is usually determined somehow by the quantum state. But this distribution, the assumption is that this distribution is independent of the measurements that we make later on. So the probability of having a certain state at the emission, lambda 1 rather than lambda 2 or lambda 3, depends on the preparation of the source, but it's independent of the measurement that we might decide to conduct later on. And that's very, I mean, intuitive idea, is the idea that, and that's the idea that we use in physics all the time, that we can prepare systems, I mean, in a source, independently, and the probability of the states would be independently of measurement that we decide to conduct later on. So that's the lambda independence. Another assumption is, I mean, the model has to reproduce the statistics of quantum mechanics. So the assumption is that you reproduce the statistics of the quantum mechanics by averaging over the probability that of outcome in each fundamental lambda states. So you can run the experiment, the first time that you run the experiment, you get the state lambda 1, and there are certain probability of outcome here and outcome there. In the second run, you get a different states and you get different probabilities. And all these probabilities are very different from the quantum probabilities because they are not correlated. I mean, joint probability factorized into the product of the single probabilities. But once you sum average over them, you get correlation. I mean, an example of that this can be the case, a famous example that was discussed in the literature on causation is, for instance, in Stanford, that it turns out, I mean, from the statistics, that it seems that women were discriminated against in the admission. When you look at the university, you look at the number, I mean, of the probability of being admitted, the joint probability of being admitted and being a woman, it turns out that there was a negative correlation. So being a woman like reduced the probability of being admitted. But then when they looked at each of the department, they saw that actually the probability, the joint probability, that there was no correlation between being admitted and the gender. And that's called mixing. I mean, in general, when you have different states or different population of and you put them together, so even in each of the population, you don't have correlation between, for instance, in this case, between being admitted and having a certain gender, just by adding all this population together, you get a surface phenomena of correlation between them. That's actually the idea here in these models. The idea is that when you look, each of the population is a state lambda, one state lambda. So if you take many particles in one state lambda, lambda one, for instance, all of them are uncorrelated, the outcomes are uncorrelated. You take another state, lambda 2, the outcome are also uncorrelated. You take lambda 3, they're uncorrelated. But when you add all these ensembles together, suddenly you get the quantum correlation, just by summing over. Is that clear? Okay. So Bell's theorem is very simple. When you take all these conditions that seems very attractive for such local models, then the statistics that you get is not the quantum statistics. So it means that any model that would satisfy these four conditions that seems to be very attractive, Bell shows that each such a model would not be able to be a quantum theory because it will give just the wrong statistics. So one of these conditions has to be, we have to give up one of these conditions. Okay, so now let's go to the local retro retro causal interpretation of quantum mechanics, and we will see which of these conditions is actually given up, and that would be the background, I mean, for the discussion later on. So the idea of the retro causal models is that instead of as in most model of quantum mechanics, that the measurement in the left wing influence the measurement in the right wing directly by non-local influence, some action at a distance, and the right wing, measurement influence the left wing, could influence the left wing measurement again non-locally, there is backward and forward causation. There is a causation from the source, the particle that are emitted. I mean, they have certain state and they fly to the measurement apparatuses. They influence the outcome, but also the outcome, or at least the state of the measurement apparatuses, send some backward causation to the source, which in turn influence the state of the particle at the emission time. And by that, the idea is to, by this backward and forward causation, one can get that the outcome in the left wing, the measurement outcome in the left wing, would be correlated with the measurement outcome in the right wing. And the idea is that if the outcome in the left wing can send some, or the measurement event can send some information to the source, then the source can shape, the state, of the particle that are emitted to the right, and the other way around, and therefore they can be correlated without having any non-local influence. Now, these models are local, so they satisfy the assumption, they are local in the sense that they satisfy the assumption that the probability of joint outcome are independent of each other, so that the common cause is the explanation of the correlation and not in non-local. A local common cause, the state of the emission from the source, is the explanation of the correlation between the outcomes, and it's not due to any non-local influence. But this model they violate the assumption of the independence of the state at the source from the state of the measurement apparatuses, because basically the trick is that the measurement apparatuses, the type of measurement that we make, and also possibly the outcome of the measurement, does influence the state in the source and the probability of which state you're going to get in the source. Okay. And many times, many people think that the violation of this condition is kind of a kind of conspiracy. But in these models, It's actually have a causal motivation because, I mean, they are influenced because there is a causal influence coming back from the measurement events into the emission event. And therefore, they are correlated. Okay, the main problem, I mean, with this story is that there are causal loops. I mean, in these theories, they could be created. Some experiment give rise to causal loop in which event A causes B, and B causes C, and C causes D, and then D causes A. So there is a loop of causation, and this loop of causations, I mean, as I will argue, I mean now, I mean, are not problematic. They are not. They're not impossible, but they impose heavy constraint on the event in them, and therefore the probability in this loop behave in a funny way. Okay, so first of all, let me just very quickly talk about arguments for the impossibility of a causal loop. So there are two main arguments. I'm not going to talk in detail. One argument is that people use concept of causation or time that exclude a priori, I mean, the existence of either backward causation or backward causation in causal loops. And therefore, loops are, you can think about Hume's, I mean, or the way Hume's account, I mean, original account of causation is presented as excluding, I mean, backward causation because, I mean, the cause is always, I mean, before the effect. Now, the problem with these, arguments is that most of the people, I mean, first of all, they won't convince, I mean, the people who believe in retrocausal models, because, I mean, if they are attracted to that, it means that they already, I mean, don't take these arguments very seriously. But the other thing is that most of the people seem to believe that backward causation causal loops are possible, at least in theory. So, I mean, they seem to discount, I mean, theories. They just a priori, I mean, exclude. The other kind of argument is, and that's, most of the arguments against causal loops, I mean, they use in one way or another, I mean, the argument against time travel and causal loops, I mean, are arguments that are based on premises that are very natural and very plausible in linear causation, but they are controversial and unwarranted in causal loops. And I will actually talk, I mean, when I explain the nature of probability in causal loop, I will refer indirectly to one of the last, and I think very interesting argument against causal loop due to Hugh Mello, that is based on probabilistic causality. And I think that this argument is wrong because it's the type two arguments. Okay, so my view is that all known arguments are either unwarranted, I mean, because they are invalid, or they are based on premises that are considered questionable. But that's not to deny that some loop might be inconsistent. I mean, my argument is, my conclusion is that you cannot universally exclude causal loops. So there is no universal arguments against causal loop, but there might be particular. For instance, the following situation. Suppose that A is the deterministic cause of B, B is the deterministic cause of C, but C is the deterministic cause of not A. And these are events. So then you have A causes B, C causes A, B causes C, and C causes not A. So you have a contradiction. If you start with not A causes not B, not B causes not C, and not C causes A, again, you get a contradiction. So such a loop cannot exist, but many other can. So I will use this type of loop to show that certain retrocausal theories would be impossible because they actually mimic such loops. Okay. So far I talked about causal loops intuitively. Now I try to make it more systematic. I mean, so I'll give you some ideas about what I have in mind. First of all, when I talk about causal loops, I'm not talking about like if there is a particle or something that it goes like in circles, I mean, you know, time and again. A causal loop is just a chain of probabilistic causal dependencies. And I will use a very general idea. I mean, it could be compatible with different theories, I suppose, and maybe compatible with incompatible with others. But the idea is that in the theory that I have in mind, I mean, the cause raises the chance or the propensity, the single the objective single time probability, and it raises it beyond, what it would otherwise be in the actual circumstances. So without the cause in the actual circumstances. Now, there are problems with this idea, and it's not easy to come up with a decent theory like many other difficult concepts in philosophy, but I think that this really doesn't matter so much to my argument. The other thing, actually, it's the Bloch universe. The best way to think about causal loops, and I think that a number of arguments against causal loops that are invalid in my view, just forget at some point the idea of Bloch universe. So I think the best way is to think about Bloch universe in which all the events are there, and probabilities and causation are a kind of relation between events. I think I'm in good company because this Bloch universe view is the default position in the philosophy of physics, I would say. Okay, so the interpretation of probability, I would talk about a propensity or single time objective probability because it seems to me the easiest thing. So the idea is that events can have, the cause give a certain propensity to the effect. So when I toss a coin, the momentum of the tossing momentum could be an indeterministic cause of the coin landing on heads. And maybe one type of toss gives more probability for heads than other type of toss. And that, so this type of toss would be a probabilistic cause of heads. Now, I can run my argument by different interpretation, and I will talk about it. You can talk about probabilistic theories of causation that in which the cause raises the frequency of the effect, or you can talk even about theories of causation in which the cause raises the epistemic probability of the effect. Generally speaking, it's not going to matter so much. Because, the issue is not really dependent on the interpretation of probability, it's more dependent on the nature of the loop. Okay, I hope it will be clearer when we take an example, when we talk about example. Okay, now in the propensity interpretation, the idea is that there is a certain propensity they're determined, when we talk about the propensity of the coin, of a fair coin to land on heads, we think about some conditions or some events or some states that determine, this propensity. And it's, in a sense, this is a propensity is a possibility, is rank possibility in a sense. And you can talk about the coin, for instance. In the coin case, the propensity of the coin depends on the tossing circumstances, on the friction of the air, on the type of the structure of the coin, and the landing surface, and so on. Now, the propensity in itself doesn't say much about. It's not something that is observable. It's more theoretical. In my view, we learn about propensity from our theories, at least under certain interpretations, or we could learn. But there is this idea that in the long run, if you run the same type of experiments and they are independent of each other, then it almost certainly, the frequency would display the propensity. And this almost certainly, is motivated by the law of the large number, and there is a lot of criticism. How to understand it. I won't talk about it. It's a problem. I think that there is a solution, but again, because I can use other interpretation, I don't think that it matters so much. Okay, so let's talk about the nature of probabilities in causal loops. How much time do I have?
Including discussion, you've got another 40 minutes.
Okay. So let's take an example of a coin. A causal loop with a coin, to train our intuition. So suppose that there is a coin, a certain toss momentum, of the toss, is an indeterministic cause of the coin landing on heads, and then there is a and the coin landing on head is a deterministic cause of my perception of heads. So if it lands on heads, I see heads. If it doesn't land, if it lands on tails, I see tails. And then my perception of heads somehow influenced the momentum that I exert on the coin in the tossing event. So the idea is that there is a tossing certain momentum. I mean, tossing momentum is indeterministic cause of heads. Heads is indeterministic cause of seeing heads, and then seeing heads is a deterministic cause of the tossing. I mean, so that's a kind of loop, and in this loop, I mean, and another loop that could happen is that I toss with a different momentum. Suppose that there is only one alternative momentum, just to make things easier, and then if that happens, I mean, that could be a cause of not heads, which would be tails, let's say, just to make things simple, and then seeing tails, and then seeing tails would cause this this particular tossing momentum, which is different from the first one. So in both cases, we will get a causal loop. We will get a chain of three probabilistic causation. I mean, in two of them, the probabilities are just trivial, one and zero, so they are deterministic. We can call them deterministic. And the other one is indeterministic. Now, the strange thing about this loop is that if you think about it, I cannot get back. Okay. I mean, the strange thing about the loop is that that you can see that whenever it's heads, we get also tossing momentum, certain tossing momentum, and whenever it's not head, we get the other tossing momentum. So there is a perfect correlation between them, which means that if you look at the frequency, although the propensity of the coin to land on heads is half, the frequency of heads in the reference class of that kind of a toss, the toss of type T, you get that the frequency is 1. Now, that sounds like a contradiction, because we said that the frequency in the long run should be equal to the propensity. I mean, that's one of the ideas of the propensity interpretation. But it's not really a contradiction. And so in both loops, if you look, I mean, the frequency turns out to be different from the propensity. And the reason if we look, I mean, more carefully at the law of the large number, we will see the reason. I mean, the reason is that the law of the large number says that the frequency, I mean, would reflect the in independent experiments would reflect the propensity only if the reference class is unbiased. So only if we have a series of independent tosses that are unbiased, they are not carefully selected, only then the frequency would reflect the propensity. Now, Mellor in his argument assumed that the propensity should be equal to the frequency should be equal to the propensity, and he derived contradiction. In my view, I mean, he's right in the contradiction, but I mean, he's not right that the loop are not consistent, because that is actually something to be expected in causal loops, because in causal loops, in our loop, the reference class of the tosses is biased. It's selected. Every time there is heads, there is this kind of tosses. And every time there is tails, there is the other kind of tosses. So it's not an unbiased, and therefore, the assumption that the long-run frequency should be of heads should be very likely to be to display to be displayed in the frequency, I think is unwarranted. Okay, but that shows also that frequencies are going to behave in a funny way in causal loops, and we have to be very careful. Okay, so one problem that we have in this loop is that we can easily calculate the conditional frequency. So the frequency of heads in the ensemble of tosses of type T, I mean, is 1, and the frequency of heads in the ensemble of tosses of type not T in the other loop, in loop 2, is 0. But the problem is that we don't have, from the propensity themselves, there is no known way to calculate the frequency of which loop is going to be realized. There are two loops. There is loop one, in which there is heads, and loop two, in which there is tails. And therefore, there is no way, no known way, to my at least knowledge, of calculating the frequency of the heads in this situation, because if you don't know what is the frequency of the loops, then the fact that you know the conditional frequency of heads in each loop is not going to help you. So the main problem with causal loop is not the consistency; it's actually the problem of that we cannot predict. If we have the propensity, from the propensity in contrast to linear causation, we cannot actually predict, the frequency of events. So if you have a state, a physical state, and in normal situation, you just say you run the same experiments, the EPR many times, and you look at the statistics, and the frequency would reflect. Unless you are very unlucky, the frequency, would reflect, the propensity, the single time objective probability. But in loops, that's not going to happen. Okay, now things could be even worse, because if you have two indeterministic, I took a simple loops in which there is one indeterministic causation, and all the other connection are deterministic. So then it's relatively easy to calculate the conditional frequency, because I calculated the conditional frequency from the loop constraint. I know that every time there is heads, there is a toss of set of kind, and every time there is not heads, tails, there is a different type of toss. But if you have more than one indeterministic connection, then in general, there is no way even to calculate the unconditional, the conditional frequency. So things become very difficult. Okay. Now, in the other interpretation, I think there will be the same problem. If you take causation instead of raising the propensity, raising the frequency, the problem would be the following. Suppose that we take the frequency. So we talk about the frequency, the cause, the toss, T, of type T, raises the frequency of the long-run frequency of heads. The problem would be that if you go with this interpretation, the frequency that are defined in non-bias, circumstances, would not determine the frequencies in the bias circumstances. So there would be the same problem that you have, with the propensity, basically. And the same with epistemic probability. If you have the epistemic probability in unconstrained situation, so you assume that the toss of type T raises the epistemic probability of heads in unconstrained situation. Then when you have the constrained situation, from this probability, you won't be able, to derive the frequency of heads in the long run. Okay, so let's go back, now to retrocausal models and see how we get these nice loops, in these models. Okay, so remember, we have a theory in which the emission event of the EPR experiment influenced the outcome by the particle flying, to the measurement apparatuses with their properties, intrinsic state that influenced the outcome of the measurement. But there are also influences coming from the measurement events, either the influence of the state of the measurement apparatus or the influence of the outcome itself, that shape also the state of the particle lambda at the emission time, the fundamental state. Okay, so let's see the following experiment. Let's take a different version of the EPR experiment. It's a kind of a funny experiment in which, according to what happens in the measurement in the right wing, according to the outcome, we go and either decide to change the type of measurement if the left wing, the measurement in the left wing is intuitively speaking, if you think about it, is like farther away. It's later on than the measurement in the right wing. So if the outcome, if the outcome of the spin in the direction R is zero, is down, then we decide to change the spin measurement from the direction L star to the direction L. And if the outcome is one, then we decide not to change. Now, my argument is that this would create a loop. I mean, in retro causal models of the EPR experiment. So let's see how it works. Okay, let's start with indeterministic models. This is the model that I studied more. There are two kinds of models. There is a model in which the retrocausality is only the influence is only from the type of measurement that we make. So the relevant state of the measurement apparatus, that the state that that capture the information about the type of measurement that we make, that this influence the state of the particle at the emission time. We can have another model in which the not only the state of the measurement apparatus, but also the outcome of the measurement influence the state of the particle. I will talk only about the first one, because I think in indeterministic models, it really my conclusion in the first model would carry out over to the second one, and it's much easier. So let's see what happens in the first model. We have let's also make some simplifying assumption that I will show that they actually don't change anything. I mean, they help. I mean, the models rather than undermine the capability. So let's assume that. So we assume that the state at the source influence indeterministically the measurement outcome. But the measurement, but the setting of the measurement apparatus to measure one type of quantity rather than another influence deterministically the state at the source. Now, I will relax, I mean, this assumption later on. I will show that things become even worse. I mean, so let's keep, I mean, this assumption. The other assumption that I make, that some initial preparation or some causes that come from the past is only one directional rather than two directional. Because if you have a backward causation, it'd probably be all the way down, I mean, to the beginning of the universe. But I mean, that complicates things. And again, I don't think it changes something much in my discussion, just complicate things. So let's see the following two states. Suppose, I mean, usually a theory will have a lot of states. I mean, a retrocausal a theory of the EPR, in the EPR experiment, in the state, in the singlet state, there will be usually, I mean, there will be many, even maybe infinite number of states that would correspond, that the particle pair can have in this in the singlet state. So let's see two states. One is that if the setting the L star and the R, that the probability of outcome up in the measurement in the L wing is 3/4, and the probability of R outcome up, like the spin in the right hand side, is 1/4, and the joint probability is just the product of them. And the other state is that since the other state is a situation in which the probability of the L outcome is one is one, and the probability of the R outcome zero is one. And the reason is that if L and R are measurement is along the same direction, then as we said in the EPR experiment, the outcome have to be opposite. So if one is one, the other one has to be zero. Now, my argument, and I hope that Rod that thought about these things, I mean, would agree with me, that this will be a characteristic states in such a model. There will be many of them, not only two of them. My argument that in this situation, you get these two causal loops. If you start with lambda 1, you get the outcome y equal 1, then the setting remains L star, doesn't change, and then the setting determine lambda 1. If you start with lambda 2, then you get the outcome 0 in the right wing of the experiment. Then the setting changes from L star to L. And then this determines the state to be lambda 2. Because we constructed the state such that if you have the setting L star and R, you have the state lambda 1. And if you have the setting L and R, you get the state lambda 2. And now all the problem that I mentioned before would apply, I mean, to these loops. So they are consistent. But there will be no way, if you give me the state lambda and the probability that the state lambda gives to the outcome y equal 1, and you give me the probability that lambda 2 give to y 0, from this probability, I would not be able to calculate what is the frequency of y equal 1, the outcome, and y equal 0. So it means that I would lose actually the ability to predict. Okay. So that's what I'm basically, I'm not going to repeat. Now the simplification. One simplification was that the measurement setting, the setting of the measurement apparatus, the state of the measurement apparatus, deterministically the state of the particle pair in the source. Now, if you relax, this assumption, the problem is that you get two indeterministic connection in the loop, and then you cannot even calculate the conditional frequency of events. So you actually make prediction even worse. In the model before, it refused to go backward. Should be. maybe that's the proof that there is a problem. Okay, here I can calculate the frequency of the outcome y1 in the state lambda 1. It's 1. Whenever there is a outcome 1, you get the state lambda 1. And the frequency of y equal 1 in the state lambda 2 is 0. But I don't know the frequency of lambda 1 and lambda 2 because the loop actually, the condition of the loops, constrain events such that they always happen together, and they don't give me any information about what would be the frequency of lambda 1. So I can calculate the conditional frequency, but not the unconditional frequency of lambda 1 and y1. While if the connection from the setting to lambda 1 would be indeterministic, I would not be able in general to calculate even the conditional frequency. So things would be worse. Okay, the other simplification would make things even more complicated because at the moment I'm not sure how to think about it without a specific model. Okay. Now, other interpretation of probability, my argument that it will be the same, so I won't spend time. I think that the way out of this problem is to actually define probabilities or propensities not from states, unconstrained states of system, but to take the states of the system as constrained in the loop, and from these states, which would be different from the state in linear causal situation, and from them to get the propensity or the frequency. So the point is that the problem, that we had in the loop here is that we take a theory that has backward causation and causal loops, but doesn't take seriously enough the fact that that all events are constrained by backward and forward causation, and it doesn't. So in a sense, what you need to do is to think about the state already as defined in constrained situation. And then, if these states give you frequency, then you would be able to predict. But that's not easy to do, but I suppose I don't see any reason why it cannot happen. Okay, let's go to deterministic models. That's the last thing I'm going to talk about. Deterministic models, in some sense, they are worse. In another sense, they might be better. So in deterministic models, there are two models. Again, I will talk only about the first one. The models in which... So in deterministic models, all the probability are 0 and 1 because the connection are deterministic rather than indeterministic. So probability of outcome are either 1 or 0, given the state. And let's assume that, as before, that the measurement... we have two options, that the measurement... state of the measurement apparatus without the outcome influence the state at the source, or we can have a model in which also the outcome, in addition to the setting of the measurement apparatus, influence the state in the source. In this case, I think that there is, I mean, the difference between the two is relevant, but I mean, I'm still in the state of trying to work out the second, so I'll talk only about the first. Okay, so the first, so that's what I explained. I mean, the outcome is influenced, the two outcomes in DPI are influenced by the state of the emission, but the state of the emission is influenced by the type of the measurement that we are making. Okay. So let's take the following model. I will consider only one state of this model. The state of this model is a state that can happen in either case of our setting, in the experiment one. Just remember, experiment one is the experiment, the EPR experiment, in which there is this funny connection. If the outcome of the measurement on the right wing, which measures spin in direction r, is zero, then you give a command to change the setting, the type of measurement in the other wing, from L star, measuring L star, to measuring L. I mean, spinning direction L. So let's assume that these states can happen in both, I mean, settings. That's something that also I claim should be characteristic in such models. And let's assume that if the setting are L star and R, then the outcome both are zero. And if the setting are L and R, then the outcome are 0 and 1. Again, it's spin up and down, doesn't matter exactly what it means, just the opposite, I mean 0 and 1. Okay, so in this case, you get an inconsistent loop. You get that if the state is lambda 1, then the outcome should be y equals 0. If the outcome in the right hand is 0, then the setting should change from L star to L. But changing the setting from L star to L would cause that actually the probability of outcome now, outcome y equals 0 should be 0, and the outcome actually should be 1. Now, if you start from the outcome 1, then the setting should remain the L star. But then, according to this state, the outcome should be y0. So this loop, I mean, is inconsistent. The condition is inconsistent, like the first loop that I talked about. And therefore, such a theory could not give any non-zero probability to such a state. Now, the problem is that there are many, by similar reasoning, one can eliminate many other states. And then my suspicion is that in such a model, you won't be able to get empirically adequacy. Because for each state, I would be able to have a combination of experiment one, changing from instead of L to L star to L to L double star, and by that eliminate, again, some other states that would have been important in linear causation in order to account for the frequency, and that wouldn't work. So I mean, I could eliminate enough states, I think, that this model would be empirically inadequate. You won't be able to reproduce the quantum correlations. Okay, there are two options. One is to violate the assumption of probabilities. I mean, the assumption of probability was that for each state, each fundamental lambda states, it can give a probability of outcome for any type of measurements. So suppose that each state it gives probability only to one set of measurements. Okay? Then I cannot use my lambda 1, because lambda 1 gives to more than one, I mean, set of measurements. It gives to L star and R, one combination, and L and R. I think it helps a bit, but I mean, I think that one can create a theory in which there will be two different states, which might happen, I mean, in these circumstances, and that we give rise, I mean, to this loop. So, I mean, it seems to me that the first solution would not work. The second solution is to assume the second model, in which the outcome influences the setting. I think that this might work, but I think it won't change my conclusion from the indeterministic models, that you have to be, even if such model, you have to be very careful how you give the probability for this state lambda. And this probability should take into account not only the setting, but the whole circumstances of the loop. So my tentative conclusion. Professor? probably too tentative to show. Okay, so causal loop pose a challenge for the local retro causal models. The challenge is causal loops and the problems that these loops, cause for prediction. And my solution is that if you construct such a models, assign probability on the basis of states that already are shaped not only by the state of the system, but also the constraint, that connect this system. For instance, the constraint of the loop. I think if you do that, so if you take into account not only the state of each system, but the constraint, how these systems are put together, I think that then there might be a solution. Thanks.
Thank you, Yossi. Questions? John and Adina.
Maybe I'm trying to go back to the indeterministic coin toss one.
Yeah.
I just feel worried that if you take probability to be, your confidence in something being true, then you might not be able to have the sort of indeterministic. You might not be able to have that uncertainty because I'm going to say the picture again.
I put it in indeterministic terms because I like, because of my bias maybe, or because the way naivety. Propensity. But all you need, is actually the probability of Y or the outcome is strictly between 0 and 1. And my point would be that if you give me just the probability of outcome, the epistemic probability of outcome given the state, and you don't construct actually the epistemic probability on the basis of calculating all the loop conditions, and giving a universal, account of how to take these things into account, then I think you will have the same problem. You won't be able to calculate frequencies from these epistemic probabilities.
Yeah, if you got you're saying that the conditional probability of y equals 1 on conditional of lambda 1, that should be less than 1.
No, it would be 1. No, that would be 1, I think, in this case. And even if you have epistemic probability, if you know that y always happens, y equal 1 with lambda 1, you should actually set your epistemic probability to be 1.
Yeah, I agree. Why is there a dotted line there?
The dotted line means that if you take lambda outside of the loop, then the epistemic probability of 1, y1 was in this model 3/4. And if you believe your theory and you have the epistemic interpretation, then you should follow. So these 3/4 would not determine, the frequency.
Adina.
Yeah, this may be what you wanted to avoid talking about with the initial preparation, but I see how you can get these consistent scenarios with the loops, but I don't really see how you can embed that in a otherwise normal causal system.
I agree. It's very difficult. That's the reason why I avoided, talking about the influence backward, to the preparation. Because without a general theory and a specific a specific model that already tells you how things happen universally, it's really difficult to think about it. And things become very messy. Because it's the problem with causal loops is not that they are not consistent, that they impose much heavier constraint on the way events happen, because there are always things coming from the future and the past instead of only from the past or only from the future. So.
Right, and it seems like you would see violations of causality as you enter the loop, because you would expect, in some case, lambda.
I don't think. Think about the coin, because when we talk about quantum mechanics things, think about the coin. It's the same coin, It's the same structure. It's the same finger. If you take it separately from the loop, it doesn't change its property in the loop. But when you put it in the loop, because of the constraint of the loop, it behaves differently. But it's not that when I think about propensity, I mean, one way to think about propensity in my discussion of Mello, you think about propensity as property of some other system. The propensity of you know, heads is a property of the coin and other things. Then these things don't change. I mean, you put them in the loop, they are just the same. I mean, it's just that because of the loop, they behave, I mean, in a funny way. I mean, that's my, basically, the essence of my argument.
Guido.
I was wondering whether there are useful similarities with examples of post-selection, because that's another case in which you can get a biased reference class.
Yes, I mean, I have actually an example that I didn't show you, I mean, with a crystal ball. I mean, if you like to see it. That, I mean, you can have in a linear causation, yeah, by post-selection. So suppose that I toss a coin, and I have this wonderful crystal ball that tells me, if you toss now, it's going to be tails. I'm win only when it's heads. So I really listen to that. Now, there is no causal connection, and there is no causal loop. If I listen to my crystal ball, I mean, I will get frequency one of heads in my tosses. And why is that? Because I carefully selected. And luckily, I had this mechanism. So I don't think that the bias, actually, my argument about the bias, I mean, is in general when you have a bias. My argument is that in causal loop, reference classes are always biased. I mean, while in linear causation, it seems that most of the time, or at least sometimes, we can have a non-bias.
Finger on this point.
Just a small example that I think, you know, post-selection that does seem that clearly relevant is, for example, suppose there's some disaster, and what you have after the disaster is records from survivors. Well, if you go by the records, it's going to look like everybody survived, nobody died, right? But of course, the real probability may be vastly different, and it's the same sort of effect exactly.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the case of context,
causal
loop, like sorts you're
talking
about, we'll just have records before the event, and that's all.
Thanks.
David?
Just a small point of information. Your solution, I think, is essentially what's advocated by Phil Dow in the last chapter of his book, Physical Causation. And he does it rather more quickly than you did. But in effect, he's suggesting that you could make a search among the factors at the point of origin, and which would give, he advocates it as the solution to the EPR paradox, and it's you're following on a line of thought that's and then he actually says, I think this could be empirically tested.
I haven't read the Phil Dow's work, although when I worked on my earlier paper on causal loops, I mean, he learned the problems on causal loop from my analysis, but I haven't read, I mean,
just find a brief treatment of it the end of the chapter.
So he says that, I mean, you have to determine...
He says look, it ought to be empirically tested, yeah. And pretty much in the way you did it, you worked it out slightly gradually.
So the point is that you're referring that you can test, I mean, the difference between theories that postulate causal loops and theories that don't postulate causal loops?
He's suggesting that it should be possible to hunt for causal loops.
I suggested in another paper that if you go my way, I mean, if you don't follow the suggestion at the conclusion, then you have no way to calculate the frequencies in causal loops. And then if you run the experiment and you get results that are very, very different, and that's at least what I suggested in the past, if you get very, very different from quantum mechanics, then it might be a hint that you have a loop. But I mean, I cannot see, my suggestion here wasn't that from that if you help yourself to my suggestion, I mean, then I think it would be impossible actually to make the distinction between theories that don't have retro causation and theories that have retro causation. Because if you can do that, then you probably can, I mean, my intuition, you can prove that quantum mechanics is wrong.
My only suggestion is that he anticipates you.
Okay.
Yes, at the back.
So if I understand what you're showing with these indeterministic causation steps, that if you take that step outside of the loop and take it somehow in isolation, the frequency would match the propensity. Now, you didn't talk much about the structure of the retro causation step. It seems to me that if all of this is going to work, there must be some very restrictive form that retro causation step can take. Otherwise, what's to stop you using your freedom in preparing systems to set up the conditions of a loop that will be of the inconsistent kind that you showed? I mean, I accept that if you have a consistent loop, then everything's fine. But what's to stop you setting up the conditions of an inconsistent loop, unless some of these, the structure of some of these steps is very restricted?
Well, you see here an indeterministic, I mean, in this indeterministic loop, it's really, I mean, I didn't talk about the type of the particular physical influence, because I want, I mean, to follow the local, the most general framework of the local models, and then each theory to show how it plays out in this, you know, general systematic analysis. That's the main reason. So I'm kind of agnostic. But if you have whatever influence you have, however it's realized, if you have the probabilistic relation that drawn here, then this would be consistent because of the indeterministic connection. It could be, I mean, you can have one of the two, and I don't see why there should be a problem. I mean, I'm not saying it might be that in some situation, I mean, it won't work for some reason, but it's much more difficult to show that in indeterministic, if there is at least one link of indeterministic causation, it's more difficult to show inconsistency. Or put it in more carefully, I mean, and maybe what I overstated. I mean, you can always find the conditions in which it will be consistent, I think.
Okay, so the point being that you could go with an indeterministic step where the propensity, say, is a half, and you've shown the cases where the frequency is one, you're saying you can set up also cases where the frequency is zero, but that's no contradiction either. That's your point.
Yeah, I mean, you can. And yes. I mean, it really depends on the state. I can produce different probabilities, but I think that when you have an indeterministic connection, it gives you more freedom. You have more solutions, so to speak.
Yossi, I've got a question. As you know, I'm very sympathetic to the retrocausal approach in general. But, I mean, listening to your stuff on it, I mean, the general impression I have is that some of the difficulties that you're seeing for the approach are arising because, as it were, you're sort of trying to import conceptual machinery into the discussion of the examples, which is really conceptual machinery which belongs in a world in which there is no retrocausation. And I think this is, in a sense, crispest with respect to our ordinary notion of propensity, which, as many people have noticed, is in its ordinary usage, is a very a sort of time asymmetric notion. And we don't expect objects to have propensities which are, as it were, invariant under changes in their histories. I mean, this comes out particularly nicely in those cases of where you consider you have coins which are produced by two different mints, one of which produces biased coins and the other produces unbiased coins. You don't expect to have a kind of single propensity which a random coin has, which is in sense sensitive to the issue as to whether it came from one past, the biased mint, or from the regular mint. And similarly, it seems to me that if you're dealing with the cases, you're now trying to explore models in which you have influences from the future, you should simply throw out the idea that there's a kind of single propensity things have which is independent of what happens in the future. Now, I think where this leads is towards a kind of view which you mentioned, I forget the label you had for it, but on one of your last slides. I mean, what it leads towards is the idea that you give up on the idea that your lambdas, your hidden variables, are predictive with respect to a range of possible futures. Because, yeah. I mean, that assumption is, I think, the kind of last residue of this rather time asymmetric conception of propensities or dispositional properties in general.
Yeah, I mean, unless you postulate in your theory that lambda 1 has certain frequency.
You're still going to have frequencies of a certain kind. Yes. There's still going to be sort of general frequency facts about the world.
Yeah.
They're just not going to be these kind of future-independent frequencies that you get in regular models, which is the way of saying in terms of frequencies what I said in terms of propensity.
Yeah, I mean, I actually started, I mean, to analyze these things not because of the retro... Well, some of the... I considered the Cramer's theory, which I think does fit in this model, and it has the same problems, if you understand it in a certain way. In other ways, I don't understand the theory. And also, there was a theory, an argument against relativistic so-called parameter-dependent theory, so non-local theory that can have some loop by combining some EPR experiments. I mean, it was by Frank Arsenius. And basically, what he showed, without saying it explicitly, that the frequencies are different from the propensity or single time probability. And he thought that it was an argument against theories. And my reaction was, no, this is, I mean, to be expected in such a theories. I mean, so the problem with these theories, which are, I mean, in these theories, I mean, actually in the non-local relativistic parameter-dependent theory, there is no backward causation like this. It's only non-local causation that turns out to be a loop. So I agree, yeah. I mean, what I realized while starting to develop all these things, that's the solution, that you have to go all the way and to build a theory that give a universal, I mean, description of how the backward and forward causation play together.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right in making the kind of point you want against Meller and so on, that built into these stories is a reason why you wouldn't expect the single case propensities, if there were any, to have their normal kind of relevance for frequencies. I mean, because the reference classes are biased. But I think you shouldn't stop there. You should, as you put it, go all the way and see this as a reason for throwing out sort of propensities of that kind, simply because, as a basic conceptual fact, they're too tied to a kind of one-way picture in which there isn't.
That's the next stage. I would like to thank Rod, I mean, for our discussion, because his theory, I mean, the only one I'm aware of that gives like a general description, and I still have to check how it works, you know, how it works in these experiments. But it's very nice theory and very elegant.
Good. One last question from Janelle.
This distinction between the deterministic and indeterministic case only really applies on the global level, because on the local level you've always got an open system, and with respect to the variables contained in the model, you're never going to get a deterministic link. There's always going to be potential influence that comes out from the outside and breaks the connection.
Yeah, I mean, something that I didn't mention here, I mean, when I talk about the propensity or the causal link, I mean, I talk about the propensity that lambda 1 gives to y, to the outcome in the circumstances. But I mean, these circumstances are the circumstances of the state, the local state of the source. Now, I mean, it's not that I have any clear idea of how to work out these circumstances, but it's more conceptual. But I agree, I mean, but I think again that it would be probably a lost cause, because it's so difficult to analyze.
Okay, let's thank Yossi for his talk. And we'll start again in a little over an hour's time, about 2:20. Oh, and for any of you who don't know this area, the lunch options, if you go out of this building and out onto the road up front, turn right so you get to McClay Street, and then at that point you can turn either